behalf of myself and my colleague David Foe, we welcome you and thank you for taking the time to listen to today's webinar, Estate Planning for the Visual Artist. Ever since I lost my father to cancer 6 years ago, and I've had to correct missteps in his estate planning, the estate planning process has become a very personal thing for me, and I look forward to sharing what I know about trusts and estates and hopefully helping you to resolve some of the issues that you may have. Before we begin, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a graduate of the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law right here in New York City. I did my undergraduate studies at the University of Rochester, and I received my master's degree from the University of Chicago, both degrees in the area of religious studies. For approximately 8 years, I focused on one specific law practice area, trusts and estates. And I've worked on dozens of matters and reviewed hundreds of documents in support of my clients. My approach and what I think provides the greatest value to my clients is my commitment to really listening to what my clients have to say and using my legal knowledge, background, and experience to structure their estate plan to meet their goals and aspirations. David, you want to tell them a little bit about yourself?
Yes. I went to Brooklyn Law School right here in the city, at fourth generation Brooklyn, and I also have a degree in religious studies, so I'm nothing wrong with that, having two people with the same degree like that. I practice largely in soft IP, which means trademark, copyright, and trade secrets, but I also will help license patents. The industries I focus on include theater law. I have an exclusive arrangement with the Dramatists Guild of America to handle all their theater law. And the rest of my practice, I have some focus in companies that produce fashion apps, mobile apps. I represent artists, I represent galleries, I represent corporations in licensing, enforcement, and registration of their intellectual property portfolios.
Yep. So I just want to offer a word of congratulations to everyone here today on the call. Every process starts with the first step, and by being here today, you're taking a meaningful step towards resolving your specific challenges. I want to acknowledge to you all that this can be a complicated process, and we may not answer everybody's questions today. But if you'd like to speak with us or even schedule time to meet, I've opened up a few 30-minute time slots over the next few weeks, and we'd be happy to meet with you one-on-one to answer your specific questions. So with that said, let's get started. I'm going to speak first about creating an artistic legacy and estate planning, and then David will speak in between about protecting the intellectual property aspect. The first portion of this presentation, which is divided into two parts, is about your artwork specifically, and then the second part is about general estate planning points that I think everybody needs to know. So without any further ado, let's get started. Our goals for today are to help you think about what you own as a visual artist, and how you should protect it, and how you transfer it either during your lifetime or at your death, to hopefully help you create and plan your artistic legacy, something that lives beyond you.
Did you want me to chime in about the, one of the main questions that I get from people is, why should I register a copyright? Why should I protect this? There are some common law protections or some basic protections that the government supplies if you do nothing, but there are definite advantages. Just to give you a taste of what kind of advantages there are, I represent a portfolio that includes a song that was sung by Elvis. My client was a 25% owner of that song, four songwriters on a song from Elvis, and even today, this individual gets about $7,000 a year. That means after the song was recorded in the early 50s, so 60 years later, it's still bringing in about $28,000, $30,000 a year.
That's pretty significant. I think the important point is that you want to focus on what it is that you own and separate that from your other property. So your personal property would be different than maybe your artwork, and you keep it, you catalog it and inventory it. And this is very important to know what you own, because in dealing with larger estates, particularly when I deal with the end of life issues, when people are trying to sort through what they have, it's always a good idea, particularly if you have something that has intellectual property attached to it, to know what exactly it is that you own. So, and to be able to provide that to your heirs and the people who are going to inherit that legacy and hopefully help it live beyond you and manage it, you know, according to your wishes. So you really have to know what it is that you have. And
the best way to do that is to keep up with your registrations, especially for the visual artists, where you have a collection each year, or you have specific pieces that are more lucrative than other pieces that you've done. And there's often no rhyme or reason to it. So you end up registering everything. You go to copyright.gov, to the U.S. Copyright Office, and you want to make sure that it's registered properly. A lot of people will say, well, if I mail this poem to myself, is that protected? Or I've put this painting, a thumbnail of it on the internet, so everybody should be on notice. But in fact, registration has some other benefits that you're going to want. First of all, registration gives you the keys to the courthouse. There's no way to break into the courthouse. You need the keys. You can't sue anybody unless you have a valid registration. So if somebody infringes your painting and you go to the court, the first thing the court will say is, where's your registration? And if you don't have one, you have to go register it and then come back. But you're going to lose other benefits. For example, if you register properly, you'll have what's called prima facie proof, which means the court will assume you have a valid copyright, and it's up to the other party to expend resources, time, and money proving that you don't have a valid copyright. Another big benefit is registration brings statutory damages and attorney's fees. Statutory damages means that you can get up to $150,000 per infringement just in statutory damages. If you don't have that, then you have to prove that you were damaged. And that can be a costly prospect in and of itself. And also attorney's fees. We're all attorneys on this panel here, and even we don't like paying attorney's fees if we can avoid it. So that's another big benefit. But probably more to Michael's point is that you, once you've registered everything, you'll be able to look up your name on the copyright.gov office, and you'll have paperwork that establishes a specific piece of work as your own that you can hold up and point at and tell other people, this is mine and you can't use it without paying me or getting my permission.
Yeah. So in registering it, the goal is, I think, to create, you know, a list of what you have, an inventory of your work. And in particular, sometimes that can be a bit tricky because, you know, you may not own your work if you didn't create it on your own. If you weren't an independent contractor, you were an employee, you might own some of it, or you might not own it at all, or you might just own, you know, certain aspects of it. So it's a good idea to keep focused on who owns the work and add that to your list. So in focusing on creating an inventory, you want to basically come up with something that looks like this: a list of all the things that you, all the art that you own, the location where it is, you know, what it looks like, how big it is, that sort of thing, whether or not it's a finished work or a work in progress, you know, information about, you know, where it's located and where it's been shown, you know, any, and also any writings that support it, your creation of it, and then, you know, intangibles like and intellectual property, like David's been talking about, you know, your copyrights and your trademarks, and also, you know, making sure that you have anything listed with in relation to, you know, special arrangements with regard to the art. It's a good idea to make sure that, though, that the location of the art, how big it is and how it's being kept is important, because I've read plenty of cases where, you know, the artist doesn't pay attention to, they assume that the museum's taking care of it, and they're not taking care of it, and the art gets lost or damaged or destroyed. So you want to really keep tabs on what you own and where it is and, you know, the intellectual property rights associated with it.
Can I say something about work for hire? Work for hire is a term that's often used incorrectly. A work for hire can only exist in two circumstances. The first is if you're an employee and you've produced that work as a result of your employment there. So somebody hired you to illustrate a textbook. And that might be considered a work for hire, but even that presumes that you have all the indicia of being an employee, that you're using their space, they're withholding taxes for you, that maybe they're providing health and pension benefits. So it has to be a bona fide employment for that first version of work for hire. The second version is the one that people get most confused about. You have to have a written document that explicitly states this is a work for hire, but also the subject matter of the work for hire has to be one of nine categories. It has to be a supplemental work, a compilation, or a collective work. It could be a derivative work, such as a translation. It could be an audiovisual work. It could be an atlas, and it could be a textbook. It could be a standardized test or the official answers to a test. Those are the nine categories. If you're doing a mural or a sculpture, you're probably still an independent contractor, and it's not a work for hire, even though the contract that they handed you might say in 72-point bold type, work made for hire contract. Just calling it that doesn't make it so. It has to be one of those nine categories, or you have to be a bona fide employee.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, because I mean that I guess ties very nicely into making a record of what you own, and that's very, very important as an artist, I think, because this is how you're making your living. This is how where you're putting your energy and your life work, and you want to make sure that you know what you own. And that you have a good way of accessing it, and that people who inherit it or are managing it for you, they know what it is too, so that they can do their job. Moving right along, the next issue deals with creating a record of the value of your work, and this is particularly important for taxes, such as gift taxes and estate taxes. But also for capital gains taxes, which tie into your gift and your estate taxes. Now, how is the value of your work determined? Well, the IRS states that the value of your artwork will be determined as the fair market value. What does that mean? That means it's the price that a willing buyer or a seller would exchange the work if they have the same knowledge and reasonable knowledge of relevant facts. But that said, the restrictions that are put on the property, for example, if it's something that which you put on restriction on it that says you can only sell this work of art to X, Y, or Z, then that's going to reduce the value of your work for valuation purposes. And this is very important in particular if you are not actually selling the property, but you are gifting it. In that sort of a situation, you would have to hire a certified appraiser to value the value of your property and to explain why it is the value that it is. And this ties right in with example number three here in the slide. Bill Brown buys a painting for $10,000 and he sells it for $15,000. Sorry, he donates it for $15,000 to the museum. His appraiser's appraisal of the painting has to justify the 50% increase. That is the real crux of the issue. When you're valuing things like art and you're not actually engaged in a sale, you have to get it appraised. And the appraisal has to take into account restrictions as well as increases in price. Do you have any?
Not really. I mean, I collect rare first editions, and I just remember that the last book that Bukowski wrote when he was alive, I got a first edition of it, and then he died, and I remember my book dealer having to fight hard with Black Sparrow Press because the price had gone up so much between the time that I ordered it and the time that they were going to send it.
Wow. That's pretty exciting to have something like that happen.
Well, yeah, I don't wish for anybody to.
No, I don't either, but I mean,
But we're all familiar. If you're in the art world, that's you never know what's going to sway the value one way or another. You just don't know.
Right. And I think then that sort of ties in with my next point, which is valuation. You're also entitled to certain discounts when you get a work of art or something appraised. In particular, if you own 50% or less of whatever it is, it could even be real property. But in this case, since we're talking about art. If you own 50% or less of the artwork that's being appraised, you get a valuation discount for lack of marketability or minority discounts. Since you can't convey a clear 100% title to a buyer, that gives you a discount. Plus, there's also something which I guess ties in with inheriting property, something called a blockage discount. And you see this usually in cases of shares, of stock, and things like that, where you own a controlling interest of shares. But it also plays out in the art world as well, because if you own a large number of pieces of works of art by a particular artist, if you go to sell those all at the same time after a person dies, that could potentially reduce the value of that art. And we saw that recently in the news with Picasso's granddaughter, who was going to sell, I guess, she owns a large number of works of art from her grandfather, which she inherited. And so there's the concern, since she was not going to try and sell some of that art and indicated that she was going to sell it outside the auction houses, they were concerned that was going to reduce the value of that artwork if she sold it all at once.
The only thing I would add to that is that, you know, that happens a lot where you have heirs who disagree on how to use property, and I think we're going to talk about that more in depth later.
Yeah. But the important point is that somebody who's appraising a large quantity of art that you own could theoretically give you a discount. So that's something that you want to pay attention to, even though if you own 100% of it, if you own a lot of it, that could bring down the value as well. And let me just talk a little bit about valuation for gift and estate tax purposes. This primarily deals with when you inherit or give property away. According to the Internal Revenue Code, you can gift or transfer a debt in 2015, $5.43 million worth of property. And that's a very powerful tool for most people. It means that they're not going to have to pay gift or estate tax purposes. But if you have art that appreciates a lot in value, you could theoretically go over that $5.43 million, which you could combine with your spouse to transfer $10.86 million. But the important point also to take away from this is that when you gift, it's not all things are not equal. When you gift something, you get what is known as a carryover and basis. That means that if you created the work of art and you're gifting it, the person who's receiving it, the donee, is going to take the cost basis, what it costs you to create that work of art, directly from you. So you say you spent $200 to create a painting, and you gift it to your nephew, and your nephew goes to sell it for $10,000. He's going to realize a $9,800 capital gain on that gift. This is different from if you had given that piece of art to your nephew in your will. If you specifically gifted it to him, he would get the $10,000. Say it was worth $10,000 when the date that you died, then if he went to sell it for that $10,000, he wouldn't realize any gain, because when you gift things at death, when you give things away at death, when you bequeath things, that gives you what is known as a step up in basis to the fair market value at the date of death. And this is a very, very powerful tool now, particularly since the estate tax exclusion has been raised over $5 million and it's indexed for inflation, so presumably that's going to go up. Now, a lot of planning for transfer of works of art or whatever, it now becomes income tax planning. So that step up, it can become very powerful for your heirs. Moving right along, something that can also impact the work, the value of your art is copyright and trademark. And I'm going to defer to David on this, because this is his area of expertise. and not mine. But, you know, I have up here a definition of copyright and trademark, which David might or may not agree. But the important point is that these are pieces of these are also part of your artwork and can increase or decrease the value depending.
Yeah. When I define copyright, I try to, you know, the bundle of rights I'll go over in a second, but I want everyone to understand what constitutes a copyright. In its most rudimentary form, it's something that's original. It doesn't have to be very original. In the law, we call it de minimis originality, which means it just has to be a little tiny bit original. It has to be an authored expression. And that means that usually we're talking about something called the idea-expression dichotomy. An authored expression is something more than a fact, something more than an idea. So if I want to write about butterflies, I can write a poem about it, and that would be the expression of certain aspects of butterflies, and that would be copyrightable. Or I could write an alphabetical taxonomy of all the different kinds of butterflies. And if it's alphabetical, it's just going to be too generic and it's not going to be copyrightable. It's a fact. If I say that Christmas Day is on December 25th, that's a fact. I can't own it just because I write it down and send it to the copyright office. So that's what an authored expression is. And then the third thing, after being original and being an authored expression, is being fixed in tangible form. And that means if you're a painter, paint on the canvas. If you're a musician, some digital format of music. Something where a third party, such as a judge or a competitor, could look at this item, this piece of artwork or this copyrightable object. Someone could look at it and they would know whether or not they were infringing on your copyright or if you were infringing on theirs. So that's at its most rudimentary levels, the three things that you need to be have something that's copyrightable. The bundle of rights that's often discussed, there are five ways to exploit a copyright. You can distribute it, reproduce it. You have the right to make derivative works on it. You can display it, as in a painting, or you can do a live performance of it. And all of the other rights are really just a combination of those five. For example, reproduction and distribution of a copyrighted item, that is publication. That's what publishers do. So those are the bundle of rights in copyright. I think that's good for copyright. For trademark, it doesn't impact the visual artist as much, but it can be used. And I think we're going to see it used more and more in the coming years. A trademark is really just a source identifier. It's a logo or a slogan or a corporate name. You know, the apple with the bite out of it is a good example of a logo. The slogan might be the greatest show on earth or the king of beers. We all know who I'm talking about in both of those instances. Or it might be Budweiser or Ringling Brothers as the corporate name. And these just are a shorthand for the consumer to say, I like my beer made out of rice. I'll go with Budweiser. That's the taste I like. And they don't have to think about it. It makes for a more efficient economy. And that's what the government concentrates on when they're trying to protect trademark. What's best for the consumer? If you're going to see trademark in artworks, usually what's been established is like a series of books. The leading case would be The Magic School Bus. So the magic school bus goes to the museum. The magic school bus goes to the beach. If you do a series of books with the same front end on the title like that, and if the magic school bus is separated with different font and it has its own look, and it's on every book in the series, you can establish a trademark in that phrase. And I imagine you could do the same thing with a collection of paintings, though that might be more along the lines of a creative signature or some sort of symbol that shows that this is not just any painting, or if you're a multimedia artist, this is not any painting or any music. It comes from this specific artist, but it's going to be an uphill battle, at least at first, to get something like that trademarked. And how do these different schemes of intellectual property, these different methods of intellectual property, impact the value of your work? Well, it's protectable. I can tell you that the biggest artworks in history, you know, if you look at Broadway, you look at Wicked, Stephen Schwartz, who wrote the music and lyrics for Wicked, he doesn't get his salary because he's putting in 2,000 hours a year, and from those 2,000 hours a year, maybe he's making, I don't know, an average of $15,000 an hour. I don't know what his salary is, but it's probably up there. But he's not getting a $15,000 an hour deal that he's negotiating with some employer. He's establishing these properties, and he's registering them so that he can protect them and put the public on notice, and he's maintaining them. If somebody infringes his work, he will go after them and tell them to stop. He'll be nice about it at first, but not if you keep doing it. His lawyer won't be nice about it, I can tell you that. And, then he can exploit it. You can have programs and merchandise that you're selling, cast albums that you're selling, tours that are going on the road that have he doesn't show up on these tours. He doesn't approve anything after the initial cast album. He just sits back and collects passive revenue streams. And passive revenue streams are the thing they're the things that can make an artist wealthy.
Yeah.
That's why artists often complain that they can't make a living, but they can make a killing if they exploit the passive revenue streams properly.
Yeah, it's what they call in real estate mailbox money. So, it can be a very powerful tool for increasing your own personal wealth. So let's talk a little bit about how you go about creating an artistic legacy. And what we mean by that is not only who will inherit your artwork as it appears on the slide, but also who's going to manage it and make the decisions about preserving it and following your wishes. But to get down to the very specific, granular aspect of it, if you don't make a plan in New York State, the decision for who gets your property will be determined by the courts, and also who gets appointed to administer the property in your estate will also be determined by the courts, because your property is going to pass via the law of intestacy in New York State. So that's what happens if you do nothing. You don't catalog. You don't create a means of transferring, you know, your property and your intellectual property, that rights that are bundled up with that at the time of your death. So let's talk just a little bit about the laws of intestacy. In New York, property is distributed according to the laws of intestacy. Let's take it followed by example. It just follows by statute under certain formulas. But, you know, for example, if you die with a spouse and kids, your wife gets the first $50,000 off the top of your estate, and then the rest is divided equally among your spouse and your descendants. It's not at all a perfect system, particularly if you want to leave more to your spouse and less to your kids, or you don't want your children to inherit it when they're going to inherit it, particularly if you have minor kids. If you have a 2-year-old like me, I don't want her inheriting my property now, because she's not going to be able to do anything with it, and you're going to have to appoint somebody as a guardian for her in order to administer that property and also to take care of her potentially if my spouse is also deceased. So the idea is that, you know, if you die and leave just a spouse, it all goes to your spouse. Maybe that's perfect, but, you know, you haven't specified, you know, what you want her to do with it. You haven't provided any direction to your heirs at all. This is not a good plan. It's not a good plan to leave your art to your descendants and your heirs via the law of intestacy, because it'll cost them a lot of money not only to collect it, but they also have to get appointed, and they have to prove their relationship to you, and it's going to cost a lot of money, and you don't get to decide what they do with it. So it's not a good means. Not a good means at all. All right. So what are your options for creating the artistic legacy? And this is really where I think, you know, good planning comes into play. You can either, you know, obviously leave your artwork to your to specific friends or your family members, your wife or your kids or whatever. Or you can leave it to, you know, if you have something more tangible and worth more, maybe, potentially, you could leave it to museums or schools if you're charitable-minded. Or you can set up a private foundation of your own for the benefit of your own artwork. Or you could potentially set up a trust, you know, where you appoint trustees to manage your legacy and your artwork and who's going to inherit it and how it's going to be merchandised and all that sort of stuff that David was talking about, leveraging the intellectual property by appointing a manager of that artistic legacy. But, you know, there are some points that you have to pay attention to when you're setting up your artistic legacy. First of all and foremost, you have to make sure that your estate is liquid enough, you have enough money in your estate in order to maintain whatever your vision for your art and how it's going to be managed is. And you also have to pay attention to whether or not, you know, the person who you're appointing or the person who's inheriting your artwork shares your vision and understands it. So, you know, this is where documents like wills and trusts come into play, and setting up private foundations because you can really specify, you know, how you want your heirs or the people maintaining your artwork and its legacy will manage that property and leverage things like, you know, like reproduction rights and merchandising, as David was mentioning. And, you know, also if you're gifting your paintings to a charitable organization like a museum, you have to make sure that they're interested in your work of art. If you're going to gift, you know, your artwork to the American Cancer Society, for example, they may not, you know what to do with it, so they might wind up selling it to somebody else. So it might wind up in somebody's private, you know, collection, as opposed to, you know, it going, you know, on display like as you want it to. So, you know, you have to make sure that they're going to accept it and they're going to follow what you want if you're going to give it to a charitable organization.
Yeah, and Michael, following up on your point of leaving your artworks to people who will share your vision, and that's not always easy. And even in the worst situations, I would encourage everybody, just from what I've seen as an IP lawyer, I would encourage everybody to leave their artworks to an odd number of people so that there can be a vote without having a tie vote, or at least some mechanism to break a tie and how to work it. And as uncomfortable as it might seem, if one heir understands the art world or your legacy, the brand of your legacy, what you're, you know, the artistic integrity that you're trying to set forth more than another, as tough a decision as it might be, I think I really encourage you to go with the person who's going to best manage the artwork and maintain its integrity the way you want it.
Yeah, just a point about the odd number. That is one way of doing it. There are other ways of doing it, like you can appoint, you know, an independent trustee or something like that, or a trust protector, if you have instruments which are managing your art, or you can, you know, I guess write it into whatever, you know, trust document, or if you were to create, I guess, a corporation or an LLC, you could write it into how you would deal with disputes among the managers and the people that are really preserving your artistic legacy. So there are ways around that, but David's point is very good. I mean, if you are going to leave it to individuals, it's probably a good idea to have a mechanism for dealing with conflicts, because they're going to come up and it happens all the time. And I see this in estates where you can't get executors and trustees to agree on what should be done and how it should be done.
And conflicts can stonewall opportunity.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, particularly if there people are going to spend a lot of money litigating those conflicts. That adds up very quickly, as David pointed out. And so, you know, it's a good idea to build that stuff into the transfer vehicles that you have your choice, and which segues very nicely into how do we transfer property at death. Well, generally there are two ways to transfer property at death, assuming that you're not going to go via the route of intestacy law, and I hope I've dissuaded you all from going that route. It's much better to plan. One is by creating a last will and testament, or what we refer to as a will here in today's presentation. And that's basically a legal document that comes into being at death, which basically states who you want to receive your property and who you want to manage it. Who you want to receive your property being the beneficiaries and who you want managing it, usually your executor or your trustee. And then, you know, your trust, which is a legal arrangement. It's not the document. The document embodies the legal arrangement, but the trust is a legal arrangement where there's a relationship between somebody who's holding the property, the trustee who has the legal title, and manages the property for the benefit of another, usually the beneficiary. And so trusts, I think, are great ways to go for managing your artistic legacy, particularly if you have something substantial and lots of works of art which need to be managed. You know, you can fund the trust with your art and, you know, some of your assets, and, you know, you leave it to your trustees to really follow your wishes that are embodied in the trust instrument.
And once if you've inherited something and you haven't done, you haven't told the copyright office or the trademark office yet, you need to do that. You should always have, once you've had a will go through probate, which we haven't really discussed yet, but that's
the
court document that gets signed and sealed by the court saying, yes, in fact, so-and-so did inherit this material. You want to keep that handy all the time. You'll probably have to send a copy out to anybody that was doing business with the person who passed away, and you want to send it to the copyright office saying, I'm now the person to contact for this artwork, I inherited it, and have a copy of the probated will with it.
Yeah, and presumably also if you were going to transfer to a trust, you'd do the same thing. The trustees would write the copyright office after it was transferred into the trust. And they'd say, hey, you know, we're the trustees of the David Foe Trust containing several works of art. And so, you know, we're the people to contact.
Yes. My legal memoranda is rarely discussed in terms of art, but thank you.
Sure. Now, let's just want to basically touch on what the basic documents that are included in, you know, most estate plans. And generally what you have is you have a will. And you can either have trusts or not in it. Testamentary trusts are very nice, as we pointed out, for containing works of art, but also for, you know, benefiting minor children and keeping them from the property before they dissipate it, before they're old enough to manage it, and also for, you know, taking care of somebody who's disabled and receiving government benefits. And there are also other tax purposes of them, but we're not going to discuss that here today. And then your powers of attorney, which we'll discuss, your healthcare proxy, and your living will, which I'm going to touch up on at the end. Okay, let's talking about what is in a will. Well, I basically told you the definition of a will. We have it here again. It's a legal document which sets out the wishes of the person who writes it for where their property goes upon their death. And also, it appoints an executor, the person who's responsible for administering the estate, gathering the assets, taking care of, making sure that all taxes are paid and tax returns are filed. And then at the end, after all of that, then they can distribute it to the beneficiaries, the people who will inherit under the person's estate. And also, sometimes the will appoint a guardian for minor children. And potentially a trustee if there's a testamentary trust. And what happens after you die, David alluded to it already, generally if there's property that is in the estate, meaning that's not going to pass by operation of law if you don't have, for example, if you had a bank account and you had somebody who is a joint with a right of survivorship designation on that account, that's not going to pass through probate or through your will. That would pass by operation of law, or if you own something with your spouse, owned a piece of real estate with your spouse, that's going to pass by operation of law. But anything that isn't going to pass by operation of law, like, for example, if you have works of visual art or artwork or copyrights or trademarks, that is going to pass through probate. when your will gets probated. And basically what you do is you present your will to the probate court in New York State. That court is called the New York State Surrogates Court. And you probate your will. You take the original will to that probate court with a petition where you ask the court to review the will and all of its components and to approve it and state that it is it's a valid expression of your wishes. And then the court will issue official letters with a raised seal to the person that's appointed, the executor, to manage your estate. So probate is a legal process, and your property, which doesn't pass by operation of law, will pass via your will after the will is probated. Okay. And then talking a little bit about a trust, we've already touched on what a trust is, but you can establish trusts two ways, as I've alluded to before. There's you can establish a trust during your lifetime, or you can establish one at your death, which is called a testamentary trust. And there are generally two types of trusts: revocable trusts, which absolutely have to be established during your lifetime because you can't revoke something after you die. That means that the trust can be changed or terminated, ended before by the person who creates it, the grantor, what we call the grantor or creator of the trust, and they maintain control over the assets in the trust. And this is a very good way, actually, for artists who own a number of works of art to maintain the control of that. Of their art is by creating the revocable trust, where they would initially be the trustee, and then they would appoint successor trustees. And this is also good, like if you have property in many different states, because it means you don't have to probate a will in each of the states where the property is located. So a revocable trust is a very good means of controlling your artistic legacy. And it's one possibility. And the other type of trust is an irrevocable trust, where, you know, it can't be ended or changed without the permission of all the beneficiaries. And generally, all of your trusts that you're going to establish via will, testamentary trusts, are going to be irrevocable, and they can't really be changed without going to the court to ask them permission, even if all the beneficiaries agree. You know, you have significant differences between revocable and irrevocable trusts, but, you know, there's something to think about if you have a large catalog of art that you're trying to preserve. And, you know, setting up a revocable trust isn't really that costly or time-consuming. They're usually pretty simple documents. And, you know, you create a will which basically transfers anything that isn't titled in the trust. The only into the trust upon your death. That's one way of doing it, creating a pour over will. And the revocable trust, the only thing about it is that you'd want to make sure that you title as much in the trust as you possibly can during your lifetime. Moving right along, the significant differences between wills and trusts, I think. For those of you that have noticed, is how private they are. Wills, you have to probate the will at death, which gives your heirs at law a chance to see what your provisions are and to object if they disagree. And it's a public process, and it costs a fair amount of money to probate a will. Not that much, but it does take time to gather the assets. And you don't have any control. Your executor doesn't have any control over that over the property that passes via your will. In instances where you become disabled or incapacitated, there's no mechanism for taking care of your artwork and issuing your trademarks and your copyrights. Those can be addressed with other documents, but you know, if you're trying to take care of that in economically, the will may not be the best way to go. But everybody should have a will anyway as a backup. The other issue with the will is deals with if you own property in multiple states, you have to probate the will in all of those states in order to administer the property versus a trust, which tends to be more private. There's no probate for a trust. Usually the trustees can take care of the property that's already titled in the trust right away. And this allows for immediate access to the assets that are in the trust, but also it provides for a situation where good well-drafted trusts, anyway, provide for situations where the grantor becomes disabled or incapacitated to allow the trustee to step in and take care of the assets in the trust. Okay, moving right along, the next document that I've mentioned is the power of attorney, and what this is a legal document. It's a very important legal document. Everybody should have one, I think, because it allows you, the person that you appoint as your agent in the document, to conduct your financial affairs and to take care of your business and your property in the event that you become disabled or incapacitated. And you can create it where it goes into effect from the day that everybody signs it, your agent signs it, and you sign it. Or you can make it as what's known as a spring power of attorney. The power becomes effective upon the occurrence of an event like you're a disability or incapacitated. It's really a matter of choice. Perhaps the one that goes into effect is a little bit easier because, you know, you don't have to prove the occurrence of the event, such as your disability or incapacity. But, you know, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. You should get one done no matter in a way that you feel comfortable. Appointing a person that you feel comfortable managing your affairs. I really can't stress this document enough. The power of attorney, the durable power of attorney, is very, very important. I've dealt with mortgage issues in particular where I had a client who had a stroke. And fortunately, she'd had executed a power of attorney, and her son was able to step right in and manage that mortgage and take care of her assets for her right away.
I have a question for you, Michael. The power of attorney, it doesn't have to be the same person for the specific items. In other words, you could have one heir or one person have power of attorney over your finances and the other person have power of attorney over which galleries to hang your art, or do you think that muddles the issue too much?
I think that would muddle the issue. Usually, I thought you were going to ask me whether the power of attorney has to be the same person that's going to inherit your art, but and the answer is no, it doesn't. But usually, you appoint one person as your attorney. In fact, although you can appoint multiple people, I guess. I mean, you could have, I guess, an understanding where you create multiple attorney agents to administer your property, and then you ask one of them to manage your property. I mean, you could build whatever you want into the power of attorney. I hadn't really thought about that. But I guess that's a good point. You can totally do that.
Divide up the duties.
You could divide up the duties. You just have to make it, I guess, explicit in the part of the power of attorney form where you're talking about, you know, who does what. Yeah. And I mean, the other thing about the power of attorney is that if you have an issue where you don't exactly want there to be a conflict, you can appoint two people who you're concerned about a conflict in the power of attorney to work together jointly, and you can make that explicit in the document itself. It's a very, very powerful tool. I mean, and in New York, we also allow gifts, so you can execute a gift rider. So if you were going to gift works of art and you had a plan in mind, you tell the person that you appointed as your agent, I want you to give X, Y, and Z to, you know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you know, X paintings or X lithographs or whatever it is that you have that you want, you know, transferred. You can specifically tell them, and I guess you can build it into the document too if you want. I mean, that's the beauty of it is that it's a malleable type of a thing. I just wanted to touch also on the healthcare proxy. This is another very, very important document that everybody should have. Because it allows, it's sort of like the durable power for your health care. It appoints an agent or a proxy to help you make health decisions in the event that you can't. So this doesn't even have to be like a situation where like you have like a head injury or something like that. It can just be where you go into the hospital for a procedure and you're out for a little while. You know, if the doctors have any questions, they can ask you. You tell your doctor ahead of time whom you've appointed as your healthcare agent, and they can speak to the doctor and make decisions for you based upon what you tell them beforehand. It's a very important thing, and everybody should have it because, you know, you just never know what's going to happen in life, and I think that it's very important. And the last document that I want to talk about is the living will. Not everybody needs a living will, but basically if you have specific ideas about what you want to do in an end-of-life situation where you have a terminal condition and you're on life support, it allows the person whom you appoint as your health care proxy or your agent to make decisions about whether or not you should continue that being on life support and make end-of-life decisions for you. It can be save your heirs quite a bit of money if it's used right. It's invaluable. Usually, I mean, if the people that you appoint as your healthcare proxy have that relationship that they should have with you, where they care about you and your well-being, you know, you shouldn't have to worry about that sort of thing. It's a very, very important thing to have, and it provides your heirs peace of mind so that you don't wind up in a Cherry-Shivo situation where you're basically burning through your estate assets at the end of your life where there's no reasonable expectation of your recovery. And so some concluding thoughts. I wanted to turn it over to David if you have some concluding thoughts about transferring your intellectual property at death.
Well, it is your legacy, and you never know what's going to hit and what's not going to hit. And there can often be no rhyme or reason as to why this work of art is very popular right now and the others aren't, or this work of art has suddenly become popular 25, 50 years after you're gone from this earth. You don't know, and the main focus should be to enable your heirs, your descendants, to be able to pay for college if they can through your work. Maybe your great-grandkid will go to college because of some painting you did that you weren't even impressed with, but with time and with the way that society and culture works, it becomes a major contribution to the human race, and you don't know. So you really have to organize this as the business part of your artwork. It's tough because it's not taught in art schools, in any, you know, music schools, anything like that. They teach you how to do your craft, and they don't teach the business side of your trade. So it's good to come to the webinars like this. And the only downside of webinars like this is that we can't talk about this subject for an hour without keeping it somewhat generic, because we're talking to a lot of people with a lot of very specific issues. So if one of your specifics, if something specific to your own issue has come up and resonated with you, I know that I'm available for questions. Michael's available for questions.
Yeah, sure. And also, I mean, I just wanted, we are available for questions. We also are offering 30-minute complimentary get-to-know-you sessions, so you can feel free to contact us and set those up. At least we are at Volcoval. I don't want to speak for
you. No. I'm very happy to be associated with this, and I'll honor the same.
So I mean, please, bring us the questions that you have. I mean, I think this is kind of generic, but I think it's useful to get a good overview about what there is out there. And hopefully, it'll inspire you to think about, how you want your estate to be dealt with after you're gone. I mean, it doesn't take that long to establish your estate plan. Usually, unless you have really strange requests, it only takes like a few hours, really. And I really can't stress, having, the will and the living will and the healthcare proxy and the durable power of attorney, they're very, very powerful synergistic tools. They work well together. And, the other thing is that, you can always revisit your plan, but it's a lot harder to get started from nothing than it is to go back and to change it. So I always encourage people, get something done get something down now, you know, and then we can always, you know, tailor it, you know, when your life changes, and you have life-changing events, or, you know, if you inherit more money, or if you, you know, create more works of art, and you want to do something different, you know, it's always easier to go back after the fact, after you've thought about it, and after we have something, you know, so that you know, you can take your time, think about it, and plan right. And that's, I think, you know, important. This isn't something you should rush, but it's something that you should rush to do.
And I don't want to preempt anybody's questions, but one of the most common questions that I get are from the heirs who say, I've just inherited this big portfolio from my father or from my mother, and I want to honor them. I want them to get as much success from these artworks as I can possibly muster, but I'm an accountant. I don't know anything about the art world. Where do I start? So it's always good to think about who might be able to advise your heirs, and who might be a resource. There's a lot of not-for-profits out there who have estate memberships. I know the Dramatists Guild does, and their business affairs office will say, if you're an estate member, we'll help you organize the portfolio of your of the decedent of the person who left all that artwork. I don't know what kind of common questions you get when discussing wills with artists.
Usually it's how do I get this to my heirs and make sure that they have the rights in the intellectual property too. So when I'm writing a will or a trust, I always make sure that I refer to that and say that any of the rights that go along with this art, or if they want it separated, I say, you know, the rights go to this person or this foundation or whatever it is. Usually that's what they're concerned with. They don't usually come to me for questions about, you know, I don't know the first thing about dealing with it. Usually it's people come to me for advice about how to plan it. But after that, you know, if I deal with the heirs, they're just worried about, you know, when they're going to get, you know, whatever it is that they want to get. Those are the usual questions. So I don't usually feel that sort of question, but I think it's interesting, you know, that you do, and it's something that I'm going to keep in mind now when I offer advice to artists. I'd like to open up for any questions. Do we have any questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you all for listening, and I appreciate it very much. And on behalf of myself and David Foe, we enjoyed presenting this presentation to you and on estate planning for visual artists. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks.